Today is Thursday, January 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Joe Biden takes actions against climate change.
We desperately need a unified national response to the climate crisis, because there is a climate crisis.
Also ahead, how U.S. policy may shape the war in Yemen.
I think the administration has signaled its desire to make sure this does not have the negative impact on humanitarian relief and other essential transactions that are going to protect the civilian population in Yemen.
Plus, a look at women in Somalia's elections. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where President Joe Biden signed a series of sweeping executive orders aimed at cutting oil, gas, and coal emissions to tackle climate change. Biden says he wants the U.S. to lead the global response to the climate crisis, a sharp departure from his predecessor. White House correspondent Patsy Wuttikoswara has the story.
2020 was the hottest year on record, following the planet's long-term warming trend, according to NASA data. Aiming to cut oil, gas, and coal emissions to stave off the effects of climate change, President Joe Biden said the U.S. can no longer wait to deal with the climate crisis, calling it an existential threat.
And just like we need a unified national response to COVID-19, we desperately need a unified national response to the climate crisis, because there is a climate crisis. We must lead global response.
On Wednesday, Biden signed executive actions on climate, including stopping new federal oil and gas leases, ending subsidies for fossil fuels, taking steps to conserve 30% of the country's land and water by 2030, and moving toward all-electric government vehicles. These actions followed Biden's move on his first day in office to rejoin the Paris Accord, the global climate agreement President Donald Trump withdrew from in 2017. John Kerry is Biden's special presidential envoy for climate.
Paris alone is not enough. Not when almost 90% of all of the planet's emissions, global emissions, come from outside of U.S. borders. We could go to zero tomorrow, and the problem isn't solved.
Kerry said the Biden administration will commission a national intelligence estimate on the security implications of climate change. And for the first time, climate change will be a core consideration in U.S. national security and foreign policies. Fishwa Satgar is from the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa.
The test is going to be on how he overcomes the constraints, how he kind of drives this agenda, and even pushes back entrenched interests while working with those that are committed both domestically in the United States and internationally for a post-carbon world.
Biden said his climate action plan will help bring economic recovery by creating jobs for workers in the declining fossil fuel industry, an idea criticized as ludicrous by the president of the West Virginia Coal Association.
Why we would want to trade one job for another and go through the transition and all the costs, particularly when the end result's going to cost everybody more money.
The administration's climate plan also prioritizes environmental justice by directing agencies to invest in low-income and minority communities that usually bear the brunt of natural disasters, pollution, and other impacts of climate change. Patsy Wuttikoswara, VOA News.
Also on climate change, Australia is failing to keep up with the growing threat of extreme weather as global warming increases the risk in areas once thought to be safe. That's according to a new report which Phil Mercer explains to us from Sydney.
Australia is a land well used to nature's extremes. It's the world's driest inhabited continent, where droughts can last for years. The Black Summer bushfires of 2019-20 were the most intense on record. Heat waves are by far its deadliest natural hazard. A new report by the Climate Council, an independent non-profit organisation, says the cost of extreme weather in Australia has almost doubled since the 1970s. It's warning the financial consequences of fires, floods, droughts, storms and sea level rises linked to climate change could soar, potentially costing the country's economy up to $76 billion every year by 2038. Robert Glasser is the former special representative for disaster risk reduction for the United Nations Secretary General. He says Australia must make fundamental changes to planning new developments.
we'll be building the equivalent of roads and homes in flood zones in areas of extreme fire danger. And when those hazards strike, the damage will be severe. The second reason, increasingly important, is climate change, because we're now seeing that the places exposed to these hazards is shifting. The frequency and severity of the hazards are being amplified by climate change. And so you combine these two factors and we see the projections of increased impacts.
The year 2020 began in flames and ended with floods. It was Australia's fourth warmest year on record, while 2019 was the hottest and driest ever documented. While per capita levels of greenhouse gases are among the highest in the world, the centre-right government insists its environmental policies are responsible. Coal generates about 70% of Australia's electricity, but conservationists believe this sunny, windy and innovative nation should be a green energy powerhouse. The Climate Council report states that without stronger action, it becomes impossible for Australia to act consistently with the goals of the Paris Agreement, a legally binding international treaty on climate change. In October, an official inquiry into the Black Summer bushfires warned Australia would, in the future, face compounding disasters, where bushfires, floods and storms struck at the same time, all one after another. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Heading back to the U.S., in his first full week in office, President Biden has focused on reversing many policies of former President Donald Trump. These include policies related to the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the economy, immigration, and climate change. Michelle Quinn reports on how the flurry of new policies and actions may be received by a deeply divided country.
On this January day,
President Joe Biden came to office on January 20 with a message to unify the nation.
With unity, we can do great things, important things.
In his first full week in office, Biden, a Democrat, has upended many policies enacted by his Republican predecessor, Donald Trump, on energy policy, foreign policy, immigration, and other areas. Most fulfilled Biden campaign promises, but Senator Marco Rubio expressed a view shared by fellow Republicans when he criticized what he called Biden's executive fiats.
We now have a president who talks like a centrist, but is governing from the far left. And we're not going to be able to just sit around here in a honeymoon period and watch these things happen.
Some observers say Biden's actions signal that his administration will make a hard pivot from the Trump presidency. Julia Azari is an associate professor at Marquette University who spoke to VOA over Skype.
It's a signal of really moving in a different direction than the previous administration. And obviously that's not going to come without some level of division. But also, there's a number of polls out that suggest that a lot of these policies are fairly popular.
One example, Biden's executive order allowing transgender people to once again serve in the U.S. military. 70% of Americans supported this in a Gallup poll in 2019. Biden's call for unity and his initial policy steps, say presidential observers, mirror the approach taken by former President Barack Obama, who entered office during a financial crisis. Biden confronts a different crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic, blamed for the deaths of more than 400,000 Americans and a ravaged economy. If history is a guide, Biden has a tough road ahead. Nicholas Beauchamp is an assistant professor of political science at Northeastern University. He spoke to VOA over Skype.
You know, the Obama stuff, I don't think that the messaging necessarily worked all that well in terms of bringing the right together with the left, and I don't think it's likely to work very well now either. But it seems to me that, you know, the judgment is that it's the best of a, you know, tough situation in terms of unifying a nation that's pretty heavily divided right now.
Biden says he supports the second impeachment trial of Trump, which is set to take place in the Senate on February 9th. The House impeached Trump, alleging incitement of insurrection for his actions leading up to the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. Trump has defended his actions and denounced the violence that took place that day. But Senate Democrats insist Trump must be held accountable. Biden's call for unity seeks to rally a nation over a shared set of democratic values, even as he implements sweeping policy changes that anger many Republicans. Azari sees no contradiction.
The two sides are going to fight about policy, and they should. They shouldn't unite necessarily on policy.
Republicans may accuse Biden of seeking to cancel his predecessor's legacy. Democrats accused Trump of the same 4 years ago. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Despite slim Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress, President Biden faces challenges in getting his agenda passed. VOA's Steve Reddish explains how the rules of the U.S. Senate make Biden's task more difficult.
Kamala Harris went from being just one of the 100 U.S. senators to now, as vice president, presiding over the entire Senate and holding the tie-breaking vote after Democrats won two runoff elections in Georgia.
Please raise your right hand.
Ending the Republicans' six-year grip on control of the U.S. Senate. With the majority, Democrats can get some things done. Chris Edelson is a professor at the School of Government at American University.
What that means is a president-elect Biden can have an administration, can appoint cabinet secretaries, can nominate judges, can get legislation passed.
But how much legislation is an open question because of longstanding rules in the U.S. Senate. One of them is called the filibuster. It is a rule designed to allow a minority of senators to prevent a vote on an issue by continuing to debate it. Senate rules require three-fifths, 60 senators, to vote to end the debate. That means 10 Republicans need to agree with all 50 Senate Democrats just to hold a vote to get much of President Biden's agenda enacted, which starts with nearly $2 trillion in COVID relief. Norm Ornstein is an emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
During the campaign and since his election, he said that he believes he can find Republicans to work with. The senators who you would expect most to be willing to compromise, Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, have started by saying, we don't think there's anything necessary to do right now. We already did $900 billion. Let's wait.
But there are rules to allow Biden and the Democrats to get around the filibuster. It is called reconciliation, which is an arcane process allowing legislation to bypass the filibuster as long as it deals with budget issues, such as raising or cutting taxes and changing priorities for government spending. Passing a reconciliation bill needs just a simple majority, but it can only be done once per budget cycle. And it will leave out some of President Biden's key goals, such as passing a new Voting Rights Act and immigration reform. Again, Chris Edelson.
During the campaign, he would say, if I'm elected, I know that there are people who will work with me. And there were people on the left who dismissed this as naive and ridiculous. So I think he has to be careful about that. I think he has to be realistic.
Realistic about what can be accomplished in a divided Senate with an eye on the next election. Again, Norm Ornstein.
Remember that when the filibuster was used over and over in 2009 and 2010, in the next midterm election, Republicans won more seats in the House than they had in 100 years. And then after Obama won re-election, it was used again. And in the midterm that followed, they won back the Senate. So their game plan that's to obstruct has worked in the past, and it's likely they're going to try it again.
Biden navigated those rules of the Senate for 36 years. How he plays by them now will test the success of his presidency. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA. A near-total ban on abortion has taken effect in Poland 3 months after a top court ruled that the abortion of congenitally damaged fetuses is unconstitutional. The move has sparked a new round of nationwide protests. Led by a women's rights group, people poured onto the streets of Warsaw and other cities late Wednesday. More protests are planned for Thursday evening. A German court has convicted a 47-year-old far-right extremist for the murder of a regional politician in a brazen killing that shocks the country. He was sentenced to life in prison. During his trial, Stephen Ernst admitted to the June 2019 slaying of a member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's party who had supported allowing tens of thousands of asylum seekers into the country. Pakistan's Supreme Court on Thursday ordered the release of an Islamist convicted of beheading U.S. journalist Daniel Pearl, a decision that has left Pearl's family in complete shock, lawyers said. Ahmed Omar Said Sheikh, who was the main suspect in the 2002 kidnapping and murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Pearl, was released by a panel of three judges. Listening to International Edition on The Voice of America, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, as well as U.S. relations with Russia and China, are among his immediate priorities. VOA diplomatic correspondent Sidney Sain reports from Washington.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken struck an optimistic chord on his first day on the job.
It's a new day for America. It's a new day for the world.
Later in the day, Blinken faced reporters for the first time in his new role. Asked which actions taken by the Trump administration are at the top of his list for review, Blinken said he is particularly focused on sanctions on the Houthis that might be hindering humanitarian aid to the people of Yemen.
It's vitally important, even in the midst of this crisis, that we do everything we can to get humanitarian assistance to the people of Yemen who are in desperate need.
Asked about China, Blinken said he agreed with the previous administration's condemnation of Beijing's treatment of Uyghur Muslims.
My judgment remains that genocide was committed against the Uyghurs, and that hasn't changed.
Good morning, everyone.
On Capitol Hill, China was also a focal point at a nomination hearing for President Joe Biden's nominee to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield. The career diplomat sought to allay concerns that she might not be tough enough on China at the United Nations.
And Senator, if I'm confirmed, I commit to working with this committee to counter China at the UN, to fight against all efforts by the Chinese government to add harmful language to the UN resolutions. And
Thomas Greenfield said China's success on the international stage depends on America's withdrawal from world leadership, adding that will not happen on her watch. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. State Department has initiated a review of the Trump administration's decision to designate Yemen's Houthi rebels as a foreign terrorist organization. Earlier this month, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the designation would go into effect just a day before President Biden was inaugurated. Steve Sesh, the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, is critical of the designation in this conversation with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy.
It is clearly an effort to just tie the hands of President Biden and his administration without any really discernible impact for the better in terms of the situation on the ground in Yemen. So I'm very glad to see that the Biden administration is open to review of this policy. And I do hope they will find an avenue and a mechanism that will allow them to roll it back and make it null and void.
What would the Biden administration do to maintain the humanitarian relief and sustain the UN-sponsored peace talks?
Well, I certainly think that the way that Tony Blinken, now Secretary of State Blinken, has expressed it encapsulates what I believe are the flaws in the Pompeo policy as announced on January 19th. I was encouraged to see this week that the Department of Treasury has announced that it will allow for 30 days all financial and other transactions in Houthi-controlled territory in Yemen and those even impacting directly the Houthis to continue while the review of the policy proceeds. So I think this is a very clear signal sent by the Biden administration that it is going to do what it can to roll back this misguided attempt at somehow bringing the Houthis to the table. I think this is going to make it more difficult for the Houthis to be cooperative. It'll drive them further and further away from the kind of a posture we would like to see them adopt regarding the UN negotiations. And I know that Martin Griffiths, the envoy, is continuing very strenuously to bring the parties together and see if they can't get the joint declaration signed and move towards formation now in a permanent fashion of a national unity government. So I think the administration has signaled its desire to make sure this does not have the negative impact on humanitarian relief and other essential transactions that are going to protect the civilian population in Yemen. And I applaud that, and I really look forward to them announcing a way to get out from underneath this burden that was placed on them in an unreasonable fashion by the outgoing administration.
Blinken told U.S. Senate that the Biden administration intends to end its support for Saudi-led campaign in Yemen. What do you make of that?
President Biden, when he was a candidate, expressed very clear reservations about what the nature of U.S. support for the Saudi war effort in Yemen was doing in terms of just encouraging a continuation of hostilities, armed hostilities, that were having a very negative effect and have had a negative effect. Now we're coming towards the 60th anniversary of the war in Yemen. So this has been going on for entirely too long, with too much suffering and not enough effort on the part of Saudi Arabia and even the UAE when it was fully engaged in Yemen as a member of the coalition to look for alternatives to an armed hostility and armed conflict. So I do think that some reassessment of how our assistance really sends a message to Saudi Arabia that it is time to find another way out of this. I understand that Saudi Arabia wants to leave, and I hope they can come up with a good plan. I don't think the Houthis will make this easy for Saudi Arabia, and that's been a problem all along, what the Saudis may or may not want to accomplish now in terms of getting out of the war effort in Yemen. But I do think that we need to sit with the Saudis, let them know that we are very, very concerned about the continuation of the war. Our support for it is not going to continue in the way it has been for the last now nearly 6 years. So we do need to set a new course.
That was Steve Sesh, the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, speaking with VOA senior analyst Ahmed Al-Shanawi. Somalia's prime minister this month announced a 30% quota for women lawmakers chosen in February's indirect election by Somali clans. If upheld by the clans, it would raise the number of female representatives by 6%. But women's groups see even that slight jump as doubtful in patriarchal Somalia. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Leading up to Somalia's elections, Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble vowed to women leaders that nearly a third of seats in parliament would be reserved for female lawmakers. This is the Prime Minister's spokesman, Mohamed Ibrahim. He says that the Prime Minister has promised that he would ensure women are allocated for their 30% quota. The Prime Minister speaks with honesty, Ibrahim says, and has vowed to solicit the support of clan elders and all stakeholders as a way of realizing this dream of 30% quota for women's political representation. But Somalia's women activists remain skeptical that the male-dominated clans who will choose lawmakers in the indirect election will follow the government's lead. Jawahir Barqab is chairwoman of the Benadir Women Organization. She says Somali male leaders ignoring the importance of women's input has hurt Kilya Kostis. She says that since men killed each other, destroyed our country, and still cannot agree, women have realized it's our turn to show leadership, beginning with the 30% quota in both houses of parliament. Now, she says, women have 24% of the seats, and we need to claim the 6% held by the various clans. Our worry is that it will be difficult to even get the 6% to fully make it 30% as promised. Women leaders note that mothers and wives have played a key role in reconciling communities torn apart by years of conflict in Somalia. Hanifa Habsade is Somalia's Minister of Women and Human Rights Development. She says that women are actually more than 50% of the population and they deserve the right to equal representation in the executive and legislative branches of government. The reason why we are stuck in the 30% quota is due to our culture, she said. Women's rights are a new phenomenon in Somali culture, but women deserve more seats. Whether or not Somalia's clan leaders agree will be made clear in upcoming elections. The vote is due to take place by February 8th, but may be postponed while political leaders try to finalize the election process. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
That's Mohammed Sheikh Noor in Mogadishu, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.